And now it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. And this show is produced at Free Radio Santa Cruz. And I want you to get yourself a pencil and paper, because it just might be something you want to write down, notes you want to take, places, times, web pages, dates. You never know what you may want to recall later on. So do have a pencil and paper handy. Let's start off with announcements. Volunteers are needed for next Sunday's Pajaro River cleanup. The Trout Unlimited cleanup on the Pajaro River is planned for next Sunday, July 20th, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Jeff writes that he needs to get an idea of whether or not we'll have a suitable number of volunteers. Please respond to his email. I'll give you that in a second. If you plan to attend, if we don't get enough volunteers, the project will be postponed again to a future date. Jeff, I'd like to get more notice on this. I got this a day ago. Anyway, that email address is Jeff, G-E-O-F-F, at centralcoastflyfishing.com. G-E-O-F-F at centralcoastflyfishing.com. If you can help clean up the Pajaro River on Sunday, July 20th from 9 to 2. And I'm sure it needs a cleanup. Hopefully you all can get out there and do a good job. Here's the Round River Rendezvous, written by Dennis Fritzinger of Armed with Visions, as found on the Earth First Newswire. This year's Round River Rendezvous, affectionately known as the Rondi, was held at West Branch Campground in Northern California, just up the road from Happy Camp and 4 miles or so from Poker Flat. The advantages of the site were it was easy to get to. There were numerous campsites and workshop sites. There was a cold creek running through it, where we could cool off during the hottest days and draw our drinking and washing water from upstream from there. The kitchen was well organized and morning circles were well run organizationally. Everything was very smooth. However, several days were in the temperatures of the hundreds, and on those nights, the nights were warm enough to sleep without a sleeping bag until about 5 a.m. when things finally cooled off. We also had a few cooler days for variety and some cooler nights. The entrance road made a big loop when you reached the main camp, and there was a latrine not so far away that was convenient. There were also latrines out in the woods. Fire danger was high, and fires were only allowed in a few select spots, namely the rowdy campfire and kitchen area. Other spaces made use of tiki torches, and that worked just fine. There were a fair number of dogs, and that caused problems occasionally, but that's about par for a ronde. Interpersonal relations generally went very smoothly, but the conflict team was available in case there was a need. Everyone was respectful of the need to keep intoxicants out of the public and family areas, so I didn't see any problems there. The rendezvous was multi-generational, from infants up through grandparents, and as far as I could tell, everyone self-identified as an Earth Firster, except for a reporter or two and a very small contingent of green anarchists. General impression, Earth First is as young as it ever was. It's only me that's getting older, Dennis writes. Workshops he went to: Deep Ecology, Earth First History, Ancient DNA, Journal Workshop, and a workshop on the Matol. And the Warrior Poet Society had 4 people attending. There were numerous conflicts to every workshop, but there were quite a number of really great ones. Mosquitoes, yes, there were a few at breakfast, but most came out at dinner time, except for the mosquitoes. Butterflies were the most numerous invertebrates. I also saw a dragonfly, a metallic wood-boring beetle with beautiful metallic green wing covers, and a small scorpion that glowed green under an ultraviolet light. There was the familiar dawn chorus of birds, but birds seemed to be mostly silent during the day, or maybe I was just too busy meeting people to notice them. Except for the birds and humans, there were no vertebrates around that I noticed, no ground squirrels, chipmunks, deer, bears, or any other. For trees, we had Doug fir, hemlock, and madrone, and in the understory, raspberries and poison oak. And lots of it. Skies? Well, a few clouds now and then, but no rain. There was a welcome back party for Jonathan Paul and Rod Coronado on Friday, July 4th, up at the Rowdy Fire. We had a good crowd. And there was a rally on Saturday, July 5th. The first 2 hours were down at the morning circle, close to the camp kitchen. Dennis tried out some new material, he says. Then we had a break and moved up to the Rowdy Fire, where it went on into the wee hours. People seemed to enjoy both parts of the rally. Part one was in a general space, so it was alcohol-free. Part two had a couple of kegs. Sunday was the journal workshop, as well as planning for the action at Seneca Biomass Burner in Eugene. One thing different about this year's Rondi is the amount of attention we were getting from law enforcement officers. They were stopping nearly every car that came up to the Rondi, and some cars were even stopped twice. If they found the smallest infraction, they'd search your car with a dog. So there you have it. Dennis Fritzinger's Rendezvous Report. He says he should also mention that he brought a bag full of copies of Roadkill on the Highway of Love and gave them all away in 2 days. Anyway, Dennis Fritzinger, our reporter for the Round River Rendezvous for 2014, longtime poetry editor for the Earth First Journal. You can see his work at Armed with Visions. And Six Nations and allies have evicted Enbridge workers from Swamp Line 9 and the Earth First Newswire. Individuals from Six Nations and their allies have interrupted work on a section of Enbridge's Line 9 pipeline. The work stoppage began around 10 a.m. Thursday morning. Individuals involved asked workers to leave, asserting that the land is Haudenosaunee territory guaranteed under the Haldimand deed and that Enbridge workers were present without consent or consultation. Meaningful consultation isn't just providing information and going ahead without discussion. It's giving the opportunity to say no and having a willingness to accommodate, said Missy Elliott. Enbridge left a voice message on a machine with one person. That's not meaningful. That's not even consultation, said Emily Corbeau, there in support of Six Nations, pointed out. Those involved intend to host an action camp, filling the time with teach-ins about Six Nations history, Indigenous solidarity, and skill shares centered on direct action. The group states they've tried the other processes available to them and here were there out of necessity. We've tried pursuing avenues with the NEB, the Township, and the Ground River Conservation Authority. Our concerns were dismissed. What other choice do we have if we want to protect our land, our water, and our children? Missy Elliott of Six Nation asks. Under Bill C-4 of the section of the Grand River adjacent to Enbridge Worksite and Pipeline is no longer protected. Approximately 500,000 people rely on drinking water provided by the Grand River. This isn't just about Line 9 or Northern Gateway, Energy East, or Keystone XL. This is about pipelines, all of them, Daniel Boissonneau of Turtle Clan asserted. This is about the tar sands and how destructive they are to expand, extract, and transport. This is a continental concern. It's not just a Six Nations issue or an Indigenous issue. We share the responsibility to protect our land and water as human beings, Elliott stated. And if you want more information and directions to the protest, go to www.facebook.com/swampline9. That's S-W-A-M-P-L-I-N-E 9. And Germany's Hambach forest occupation calls for solidarity and support in this story written by Gook from the Hambach forest occupation as found on the Earth First Newswire. Greetings and salutations from the Hambach forest occupation. We are presently blocking the expansion of the largest open cast lignite mine in Western Europe with tree sits and barricades throughout the Hambacher forest. After the last eviction on March 27th of this year, we reoccupied the forest, this time building up two tree sits with multiple platforms, tree houses, and walkways in between, not to mention our barricades. At present, we are facing regular intrusion of repressive law enforcement destroying our structures on the ground and have already faced two large-scale evictions using tactical teams costing millions of euros, while at the same time the German government is cutting sustainable energy subsidies. instead choosing to compensate for the shutdown of nuclear power plants with support from the extremely polluting and ecologically catastrophic coal industry. In our case, RWE Power Company, which is engaging in a massive greenwashing PR campaign. We would like to send you updates and inform you of the upcoming Climate Camp and Skillshares Gathering, July 26th through August 3rd, happening in our vicinity, which we are also helping to organize. We also have a support camp with legal status at the edge of the forest, functioning as a de facto activist eco-village, with a vegan kitchen, guest trailers, straw bale structures, gardens, and many other ongoing sustainable projects, to which we would like to invite all of you who may find yourselves in our neck of the woods. There is a sense of urgency, though the forest has been occupied for 2 years now, there is a new autobahn ready for opening in September, bypassing the one separating the last remnant of forest from the mine, which would allow the mine to expand and logging and strip mining to commence on the last remnant of forest. We expect that to be the time of mass police actions. For that reason, it is mega important to get the word out and keep people involved, inspired, and on track of the importance and the context of our struggle. As of recently, we have also built an info shop library for which we would like to appeal for any extra literature that you will be willing to share with us. We would cover the costs of shipment and, if possible, discount rates of literature itself, not to mention we would be extremely interested and grateful if you would be willing to share any back issues or extra literature. If this is a possibility, please also respond with your preferable snail mail address, as we would like to share some of our material with you as well. We have a support center in Düren, Germany, which is unfortunately undergoing a bit of transition at the moment. Big thanks for all of your literature and inspiration that has been finding its way to the Hambacher Forest. For the time being, the literature for our Meadow Base Camp info shop and the climate camp could be sent care of one of our supporters, Frau Annika Lundberg, Rohrbachster 37, 60389 Frankfurt am Main, Germany. Once again, Frau Annika Lindeberg, Rohrbachster 37, 60389 Frankfurt am Main, Germany. And I won't even attempt to spell any of that. Look up the Earth First Newswire, and all the information can be found there. Moving to Texas, Collier County activists drive oil company from the Everglades. I guess this is Florida. It's a Texas oil company. That's it. This story by Fire Ant. New Times published it, and it is found on the Earth First Newswire. Prospectors from Texas oil company Dan A. Hughes won't be drilling throughout the Big Cypress Swamp watershed anytime soon. That means, one, diminished revenues for old Florida plutocrats Baron Collier, one fewer threat to the Florida panther and other species, and one fewer worry for Collier County residents concerned about toxic contamination of their environment. The Texans had leased mineral rights on 115,000 acres of land from Collier Resources over the past few years, including portions of the Florida Panther Wildlife Refuge, Picayune Strand State Forest, Fakahatchee Strand Preserve State Park, Big Cypress National Preserve, and the Audubon Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary. Some wells adjoined residential neighborhoods in Naples, Florida. Regulators busted the drillers for unauthorized fracking at a Collier County well last December, which neither the state nor the company disclosed at public hearings this year. And when the news broke this spring, it scandalized and already aroused citizenry and provoked official local resistance. Unable or unwilling to play well with others, the company stiffed the efforts of state officials to smooth things over. The drillers chose to skedaddle. One exception remains, the Hughes drilling operation at the Collier Hogan site, where last winter's acid fracking occurred. That project faces a legal challenge from the Collier Commission, which has asked that its permit be revoked, as well as a warning from the Department of Environmental Protection Secretary Herschel Vineyard who has given the drillers until next Tuesday to meet a set of demands regarding operations and transparency. The citizens' victory vote sounded in the form of a Hughes announcement Friday that the company had assisted or had assessed its capital budget and its prospects in other parts of the country and decided to allocate its resources to other project areas. That same day, in a letter to the Collier County Board of Commissioners, Collier Resources announced that the Hughes leases had been terminated. We'll see soon if Vineyard can walk the walk. In the meantime, Collier County's environmental activists are in a mood to party. And the story is written by Fire Ant, an invasive species tinged bright red with an annoying, sometimes fatal sting, covers South Florida news and culture. Got a feedback or a tip? Contact fire.ant at BrowardPalmBeach.com. That's fire.ant at BrowardPalmBeach.com. And emergency water conservation regulations for timber harvesters have been enacted. In light of the unprecedented drought, the California Board of Forestry and Fire Protection adopted emergency regulations to conserve water for fish habitat and drinking water for Californians. The regulations became effective June 19. The new water drafting emergency regulations require approved timber harvest plans on private timber lands and plans pending approval to disclose all water drafting operations, drafting rates and volumes, compliance with Fish and Game Code Section 1600, and potential effects on downstream aquatic habitat. The emergency regulations will be in place for 180 days. Quote, the severity of the drought we are experiencing makes it imperative for all of us to conserve water wherever possible, stated Dr. J. Keith Gillis, California Board of Forestry and Fire Protection Chairman. These emergency regulations will help landowners evaluate the cumulative effects of forest management on all resource systems and values, unquote. Additionally, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife and the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection are drafting a joint letter to private timberland owners and foresters. The letter summarizes the new regulations and provides a reminder that approved timber harvesting plans require compliance with Fish and Game Code Section 1600. The letter will also state that timber harvesting plans must provide background on multiple drought impacts to fisheries, wildlife, and domestic water supplies. Licensed timber operators will be required to ensure that water is not removed in quantities harmful to domestic water supplies, fish, wildlife, or other current beneficial uses of the water. State agencies responsible for regulatory compliance of timber operations will continue to pay close attention to water diversion activities on all active timber harvest plans and will continue to work to ensure that water conservation is implemented to the extent feasible. Governor Brown has called on all Californians to reduce their water use by 20% and prevent water waste. Go to www.saverh2o.org to find out how everyone can do their part, or visit www.drought.ca.gov to learn more about how California is dealing with the effects of the drought. Statewide, Californians are saving around 1% water compared to normal years. Not enough, folks. Conservation group demands that the United States restore grizzly bears to their native range. Story reported by Laura Zuckerman, editing by Eric M. Johnson and Jim Loney, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. The outsized hump-shouldered bruins were hunted, trapped, and poisoned to the edge of extinction in the lower 48 states before being added to the federal endangered and threatened species list in 1975. The Center for Biological Diversity argued in a formal petition submitted to the U.S. Interior Department that grizzlies should be restored to their native range in such places as California's Sierra Nevada and the Grand Canyon of Arizona. The areas, it said, still contain large tracts of undeveloped habitat favored by the bears. We've just begun the job of recovering grizzlies. There is so much more to do to see the bears restored to more of their range in the western United States, said Noah Greenwald, endangered species director for the Center for Biological Diversity. The Interior Department's Fish and Wildlife Service could not immediately be reached for comment Under federal rules, it can accept or reject the petition. An estimated 1,600 grizzlies roam Yellowstone National Park and its border states of Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. The proposal by the Center for Biological Diversity would see as many as 6,000 grizzlies in the U.S. West, including parts of Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, and Utah. The petition was filed under an administrative component of the Endangered Species Act. It says expanses of rugged terrain in the northern Rockies where grizzlies have been reestablished represent a small percentage of the predator's historic range and just 22% of potential suitable habitat in the continental United States. The push by the Arizona-based group comes as government managers of grizzlies in and around Yellowstone claim that the population of more than 600 bears is sufficiently recovered and should be stripped of federal safeguards, opening the way for hunting them outside the park. The Center for Biological Diversity argued that the Fish and Wildlife Service is obligated under provisions of the nation's landmark conservation law to develop a recovery plan that ensures restoration of grizzlies in ecosystems such as the Southern Rockies and the Sierra Nevada. And a bird conservancy group sues the United States over 30-year permits to legally kill eagles in this story reported by Laura Zuckerman, editing by Cynthia Johnson and Peter Cooney, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. A bird advocacy group sued the U.S. government over rules it says loosened protections for eagles killed by wind turbines, arguing they threaten decades of protection that saved the bald eagle, America's national emblem, from extinction. The American Bird Conservancy filed suit in federal court in California to challenge the authorization of 30-year permits to renewable energy developers to accidentally kill protected bald and golden eagles, which may die as a result of collisions with the towering wind turbines. Eagles are among the nation's most iconic and cherished birds. They do not have to be sacrificed for the next 30 years for the sake of unconstrained wind energy, said Michael Hutchins, coordinator of a wind energy panel with the American Bird Conservancy. Federal laws like the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act ban the killing of eagles without special permits, once issued for such restricted purposes as scientific research. But U.S. wildlife managers expanded the permits in 2009 to include activities like renewable energy development, a top priority of the Obama administration, and lengthened them in December to 30 years from the previous five. The alternative energy industry had sought the changes to demonstrate to investors that developments like wind farms, many on or planned for lands in the U.S. West, would not face the uncertainty that came with applying for new permits every 5 years. The American Bird Conservancy argued in the lawsuit that by imposing the looser rules, the U.S. Interior Department and the Fish and Wildlife Service were in violation of landmark conservation laws designed to protect bald eagles, a bird stamped on the U.S. national seal, and for declining populations of golden eagles. The American Wind Energy Association said in a statement, "The permit program appropriately balances wildlife conservation with the realities of the private sector." Conservationists accused the Obama administration of recklessly giving wind companies a 30-year pass to kill eagles without assessing the impact on the bird populations. Fish and Wildlife Service spokeswoman Larry Paramore said the agency would not comment on pending or ongoing litigation. The number of eagles killed by wind farms each year is disputed. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service estimates 85 of the raptors have died that way since 1997, but the American Bird Conservancy says the wind industry has killed more than 2,000 eagles in the last three decades. And off-road vehicles are proposed by the Forest Service in the Smith River National Recreation Area in this story by Jason Landers of the Environmental Protection Information Center. EPIC, Kalamazoo Wildlands Center, and other conservation allies submitted comments regarding the draft environmental impact statement for the Smith River National Recreation Area Restoration and Motorized Travel Management Plan on June 9th, supporting a travel management decision that protects the outstanding natural valleys found in the Smith River National Recreation Area by reducing road maintenance costs, protecting and restoring aquatic and terrestrial ecosystems, and reducing the spread of Port Orford cedar root disease through road and route decommissioning. The Forest Service needs to refrain from adding routes and motorized trails to the road system that occur within occupied sensitive plant habitat, as well as fully analyze and disclose the impacts of foreseeably illegal off-road use. In addition, the Forest Service must disclose the actual efficacy of agency road gating, blocking, and closure mechanisms. Furthermore, the final travel management decision must contain meaningful and substantive protections for port or for cedar protections across the planning area. In the draft environmental impact statement for the Smith River NRA Restoration and Motorized Travel Management was released to the public on April 11, 2014. The aim of the project is to make changes to the National Forest Transportation System and motorized vehicle use maps, including adding, upgrading, downgrading, and decommissioning roads to provide for recreational opportunities, administrative needs, and to reduce risk. In the Smith River National Recreation Area, six alternatives were identified. The Forest Service prefers Alternative 6. Unfortunately, Alternative 6 is primarily based on the preferences of a collaborative group whose stated purpose was to determine how to add high-risk, controversial, user-created routes to the Smith River National Recreation Area National Forest Transportation System. These high-risk routes provide no administrative or recreational purpose other than to fulfill the desire to engage in extreme off-road travel. In addition, the preferred alternative would add routes and motorized trails to the National Forest Trail System, transportation system that occur within occupied sensitive plant habitat. It is undeniable that the existing network of roads and routes within the NRA are a major cause of chronic sedimentation problems in streams, cause damage to rare and endemic plant populations, contribute to the loss of roadless wildland recreation opportunities, and increase the spread of Port Orford cedar root disease. Although the Forest Service acknowledges these problems, it plans to monitor less than 1 in 5 of these high-risk routes over the next 10 years if funding is even available. And we hope EPIC and its allies hope that the preferred action is not preordained and that substantive technical and site-specific comments are adequately acknowledged and addressed. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is produced every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you'd like to hear a rebroadcast of this show, tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock for a rebroadcast of this week's Earth First Update. If you live in Moscow, Idaho, KRFP 90.3 FM broadcasts the Earth First Update on Monday nights at 9:30. And you could also download or listen to a podcast of this Earth First Update at radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net. And I'd like to add that radioforall.net needs your support. They are a user-supported archive service, and they have been archiving Earth First Updates and Earth First Radio specials for many years. They've recently had some hard times, and they need an infusion of new cash to keep their hard drives and servers running. So go to radioforall.net, click on the top banner, and please donate as much as you can. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.